and this is my impression of a Hollywood acceptance speech.
I'm so surprised! I had no idea! I'm not even prepared!
Okay. I'd like to thank the Progressive discounts that got me here. Safe driver multi-car, paid in full multi-policy. This is just such a big moment. And did I mention that I'm surprised?
With all kinds of discounts, Progressive helps you save.
Oh, and I want to thank my agent and all my discounts agents because we all have the same agent.
Don't start the music!
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company. Discounts not available in all states or situations.
Blog Talk Radio. Now, coming to you live from Fort Lauderdale Executive Airport in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, it's Plain Talk Radio, a talk show dedicated to promoting an appreciation and understanding of business aviation, hosted by Stuart Lapayoker. It's Plain Talk Radio.
Exploration of space will go ahead.
And it is one of the great adventures of all time.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Many years ago, the great British explorer George Mallory on Mount Everest was asked, why did he want to climb it? He said, because it is there. The space is there. And we're going to climb it.
Okay, welcome to Plain Talk Radio for Friday the 13th, May 13th, 2011. I'm your host, Stuart Lapayoker, coming to you live from Fort Lauderdale. And I'm joined by my guest co-host, Oliver Ross from the UK. We've got a great show for you today. Joining us is Tom Coughlin from Ayrshire, corporate aircraft insurance broker and consultant, and David Linnemeyer of Linnemeyer Aviation Advisors, and veteran aviation manager of large corporate aircraft flight departments. We'll be talking about what to do with your corporate aircraft in the event of an imminent hurricane or other natural disaster. Be sure to enter the chat room on your screen or give us a call with your questions or comments using the numbers you see on your screen or our toll-free number, 877-511-1032. Or if you've registered at Blog Talk Radio, you can click to talk or Skype us. We'll have Plain Talk Radio t-shirts for the first 10 callers wanting to ask questions. You can add us to your iTunes from the Blog Talk Radio, Plain Talk Radio page and follow the show schedule using some widgets on the page that will drop the show onto Outlook and other calendar software. Actually, the show pages have changed and they're actually pretty sleek now. If you have a new product or service that serves the business aviation community and would like to be interviewed, drop us a note at airplaneguy@plaintalkradio.com. There's the usual disclaimer you can hear on our archive shows. Although the show may touch upon legal, tax, or regulatory issues, nothing contained in the broadcast should be relied upon as legal advice appropriate to your situation, which can only be given by your own legal counsel, and the opinions you hear of our guests represent their personal views and not necessarily those of the organization with which they are affiliated or Plain Talk Radio. And I want to skip that one next time. Coming up on May 17th, 18th, and 19th is the European Business Aviation Conference and Expo in Geneva, Switzerland, and we'll be there checking it out and meeting, as we usually do, with our friends and various manufacturers and vendors. We'll try to do some interviews to bring to you on tape on the next show. June 9th and 10th in New York is the 2011 Business Aircraft Transactions Conference at the Hilton, New York, sponsored by NBAA. There are distinguished panelists, one you're going to recognize. Conference is a must for anyone involved in business aviation, be they owners, attorneys, accountants, brokers, etc. Plain Talk Radio is pleased to be one of the sponsors. Go to nbaa.org for additional information and sign-up forms. Also on June 3rd, NBAA is having its NBAA Business Aviation Taxes Seminar in San Francisco. Check out globalaviationhub.com, an online aviation directory. There's a link on our show page to the site. It's a pretty cool site. Coming up on June 1 in Oklahoma City is an open meeting with the FAA to discuss the use of owner trusts to register aircraft by non-U.S. citizens. As you may know, the FAA has expressed concern over this practice allowed by the statute and the regulations, and if you're not a U.S. citizen under FAA definition and you have or will be using this structure, stay tuned. Oliver, welcome back.
Hi. Welcome from sunny London, although
we have, is it really
late in the afternoon?
We've all made it through the wedding, I must say.
Yes. Yes, and in fact, half the law firm for which I work is now actually back at their desks. They were living in tents on the lawns of Clarence House for many weeks.
I must tell you that the precision with which that went off was incredible.
Ah, yes. Well, you have to be a Brit to do that.
To appreciate that.
It's a little bit like the soldiers on the parade. I mean, who can do that? I mean, who can look that neat? I can't.
I mean, that was unbelievable. When they said it was going to be over, it was over. The only thing I was disappointed in was I thought that when they asked her if, you know, she will love, honor, cherish, da da da, I thought she'd say absolutely, but all we got was like a little yes, I will.
Yeah, and also that she didn't include obey.
Now
right? There's a thing.
was that negotiated out? Was that part of the
negotiation?
Oh,
yes.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, yes. The shape of things to come, maybe.
Okay. But they did say, did they say man and wife or husband? They did say man and wife and not husband and wife, which is a big sticky thing.
I
here
think
you know.
So.
Okay. All right. Well, anyway, there's some tradition left in the world. Tom and Dave, enough of that nonsense. Tom and Dave, thanks for being on the show. Welcome.
You're quite welcome, Stuart. Thank you.
You're welcome, Stuart.
Tom, tell us a little bit about AirSure and what you do before we get into some of the substance.
Okay. Happy to, Stuart. We're a aviation insurance and risk management firm located here in Ormond Beach, Florida. We've been doing this for some 35 years, and a good portion of our clients are corporate flight departments, but we also handle charter management companies and some manufacturing risks and some airline service companies.
Okay, great. Dave, a little bit about your background. I know you've been an aviation manager for 30 years. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, actually, it was probably closer to 35 years. It was some Fortune 500 companies and then some high net worth individuals, and got to see all the different facets of from corporate to private flight operations all over the world. A lot of fun.
And you also were a pilot, and you didn't just fly little airplanes. You were flying Boeing business jets, G4s, and other large aircraft.
Correct.
How many hours?
Nine type ratings.
Nine type ratings. How many hours would you say you have in jet aircraft?
About 17,000.
There you go.
Enough.
Well, sorry?
Enough.
Enough. Well, the topic of the show today is really about hurricane preparedness, which is appropriate. We're in the season now here in South Florida. And hopefully this will be applicable to other people listening to the show. So let's just start out with a very basic question, which is a hurricane is announced or there's information about they're tracking a hurricane. Where do we start from the, let's say, from the risk management insurance perspective, Tom? And then we'll get to some of the practical aspects in the flight department.
Sure. Well, I think the starting point, Stuart, is for people to sort of be prepared for some type of a disaster and have a written response and recovery plan. The time to be thinking about it you know, isn't when you're watching these things, you know, roll through the Caribbean and you're literally a day or two before they, you know, might cross the Florida Peninsula or work their way up the East Coast or into the Gulf. So we're big proponents of having a written response and recovery plan way in advance of the storm season. And the components of the plan ought to be the pre-storm, what you do when, what you should be doing during the storm, and then what the recovery would look like after the storm has passed. And I wouldn't limit it to just hurricanes. I think, you know, the plan has to be pretty specific in address other types of disasters. You know, we learned that as a business ourselves, and, you know, we've activated our own disaster plan five times since 1992, and in one of those cases, it was wildfires, and we had literally an hour to evacuate our offices. So don't be lulled into just what's, you know, very apparent that wind is a problem in Florida, because there's many other types of disasters or problems that could force you to evacuate your facilities and people and respond to a different type of disaster. And I'm happy, Stuart, to kind of walk through different components of the plan and things that ought to be considered. And later, as we talk through this, I can sort of share with the group, you know, what we've sort of learned from a series of storms and tips that we've gotten from a number of operators from having actually lived through some of these disasters.
Sure. Yeah, go ahead. We're all ears.
Okay. Well, I think as part of the plan, the first step is to really kind of appoint a coordinator within the flight department or the aircraft management company that is going to be responsible for documenting and pulling together the various components. I mean, and it, you have to have management buy-in from downtown at headquarters. They need to be an integral part of it. You need to have your accurate employee lists and contact numbers. And it's like any other type of disaster response or recovery plan. You need to review and rehearse it. And it's only as good as how current it is. And in our case, we encourage our clients to review it annually. And we find that it really gets pretty stale if you let it go beyond that. And I think when you're doing the plan, again, back to the specific types of disasters, because there's a different response for, you know, wildfires versus a tornado versus a hurricane or a roof collapse from snow. And you need to be thinking about all of those types of scenarios and the what-ifs and then putting into the plan what your response might be. I think, you know, some other key components within the plan are, what are the external communications going to look like to your customers or to the community in general? You need to be thinking about if your facilities are destroyed, where are you going to move to? Where's the temporary location? Do you have any type of mutual aid agreements that you could form with other operators or affiliated companies? And I think, again, something that sort of dawned on us after we've activated our plan on one or two occasions is that we hadn't adequately addressed really the personal disaster plans for our individual employees. It's critical that they're thinking about what they're going to do with their homes and their families and pets and what have you, because if they're not looking after it, that actually becomes your problem. And
well, let's talk about that for a second. I know we're going backwards a little bit, but I mean, Dave, if you are activating your plan and presumably dispatching your aircraft to safer locations, you have crew issues to deal with, and it's not just, you know, how do they get here? It's, you know, what about their families as well?
Well, I think one of the things is with your emergency plan, you got to have flexibility. You got to have thresholds, but recognizing the fact that you're continuing normal flight operations until the time that you have to phase in the emergency plan, and you have to coordinate with maintenance so that you don't get the aircraft disabled and have a big name storm come and you can't get your aircraft out. You got to have your staffing so that if you have vacations that conflict, you have other issues, because you know the families are running their lives, and the flight department's running a parallel flight operations, and communication so that you have a coordinator, like Tom said, you communicate with the pilots, that you develop an understanding that if one of the wives is pregnant, is there health issues, is there relatives that have health issues, so that when the nasty storm, instead of going east or west, as we know these things have a mind of their own, all of a sudden they say, you know, it's going to impact from Palm Beach to Miami, and it's going to be, a level, whatever it is, and you say it's time to leave. You coordinate with your principal people that you're involved with, and you develop emergency contact numbers. You try to, because you know these storms normally are pretty well planned, but every once in a while we get a surprise, and then all of a sudden people scatter, and you don't have the ability to talk to them, or you have loose ends. So really planning, and as Tom said, keep, you know, don't let your plans get stale, and communication, but while you're still running a normal flight operation.
Let me just interject a question we have in the chat room, and it's probably for Tom. What are the various policy deductibles available on insurance for aircraft for hurricane damage?
Well, believe it or not, Stuart, on the vast majority of business jets, regardless of the value, almost all of them have no deductible whatsoever. It's incredible, but that's how the industry has kind of embraced the business jet community, because they have such an excellent safety record. So for the most part, there are no deductibles that apply to the airplanes. Now, the exceptions to that, you can see them on some smaller aircraft, and you can also see them on some business-type aircraft that are used in a little different venue, such as, you know, cargo or freight. You might see some bigger deductibles on those. But honestly, where you're going to see the deductibles is going to be more towards the hangar facilities. You do have very specific deductibles, particularly in wind-prone areas, that, you know, they can go to 5% of the value of what you're insuring, you know, minimums of $250,000, and you have waiting periods or grace periods on any type of business income or extra expense that you might see. And I'm putting emphasis on facilities, not just the business jets, because those are generally what get destroyed once you have a storm roll through and you're coming back with your airplanes and you've got no place to stage or conduct your business. So in terms of your question, Stuart, deductibles really aren't an issue except on the facilities themselves.
Okay. Hey, sorry, Tom, we interrupted you with a couple of things.
No, that's all right. That's all right. Do you want me to continue here?
Sure, yeah.
Okay. Well, I think...
Continue, and we'll interrupt you 14 more times.
Sure. All right. I think something to think about, too, is with your employees, when you bring them back, there has to be very, very clear communication with them as to when they report back and how they go about doing that, because in many cases we found that once they depart, they're sort of gone, and they're wherever they evacuated to, and it can be anywhere from, you know, 24 to 48 hours before you can even get them back to the workplace or even have a report from them to determine what they're dealing with on the home front. If their own homes are damaged or destroyed and they're dealing with adjusters and, frantic spouses and what have you. So I think it's important to understand that you're not going to have all your people back, and they're going to be staggered when they come back. And I think you need to be prepared with how are you going to feed them. You need to have plenty of water on hand, and I think you need to anticipate that you could be without power literally for a week or two. And I think in your case, in the Fort Lauderdale area, Dave and Stuart both experienced 3 weeks without power. That's an awfully long time. And so back to the components of the plan, you know, it had better encompass, you know, generators and, you know, hardwiring buildings to make sure you've got some sort of supplemental power source, and that you can accommodate your employees that are displaced. I think also during the storm, I think it's important that, you know, as the weather conditions are changing, that communication is happening in case you want people to report back sooner or to a different location. I think it's important as soon as possible that you get your employees that are responsible for the response on the plan and the recovery portion, that you get them back together, they're communicating, and then they go ahead and activate the response plan for what the recovery is going to look like. And I think also, too, that, you know, there's a good possibility of when you've got damage either to the airplane or the facilities, that there isn't this expectation that, you know, you call your insurance company and everything's going to be taken care of, because what our own experience is what we found is that, you know, it can be anywhere from 7 to 10 days before you even get an adjuster on site, because they're so overwhelmed by these massive disasters that our advice to clients is go ahead and begin the recovery. Certainly get it reported to your insurance folks, but get your flight department going, get your business going again, and we'll adjust the claim after the fact. But recovery first and the claim second. And as we get further into this, I'm sorry, Stuart, go ahead.
Okay, can I jump in here? Is there any action or inaction on the part of the insured which would prompt the invalidation of any claim or any insurance? Are the insured expect to act in a particular way or take certain precautions?
Well, it's an excellent question, Oliver. You have a duty to protect any property, whether it's the airplane or the facilities, from any further damage, and you have to do what a prudent person would do, not to just let further damage occur. And I think as part of that, too, if you're doing cleanup, that you're photographing what's happening. We did have an operator, not one of ours, that had taken all of the interior of one of their facilities and had just disposed of it all, and didn't have it there for inspection from the adjusters. So you have to be able to document what it is you're doing, and you have to be prudent in making sure that you're protecting what's there, so that you're not, you know, prejudicing your rights with the insurer. That's a very good point, Oliver.
Go ahead, Tom.
Well, I was going to say that, but you don't want to be sitting there waiting for somebody to come rescue, because, honestly, you'll be waiting a long time. You've got to get going. You've got to go ahead and start making contact with the repair facilities. You've got to start making contact with builders, because they're all going to be at a premium and they're all going to be busy, and you want to be one of the first ones on their list to begin that process. And you know, Dave is personally been through that with Wilma, and he could probably comment on some of that, I would think, that would be helpful here.
Well, you know, one of the things we was lulled into the feeling that we had a new facility. It was hurricane resistant. As Tom can tell you, that what we're finding out now, as you build stronger buildings, that tornadoes are the big culprit of creating damage, and we had substantial damage. And one of the early on things is when we returned was we had water in the offices in the areas where in Florida the mold is such a big issue, and you really have to be proactive and get a hold of people as soon as you can, because they're going to be overwhelmed. And we were very fortunate that we had some good contacts, and we had people in literally in a day in drying out the facility, doing temporary repairs, and trying to, you know, shorten up the time to get the flight operation back in business. We closed off a lot of the offices. We adapted to a different way of operating, but we did, you know, we had phone issues to begin with. We found one of the things is if you're away from the base and you still have people in town, we always think cell phones will always be there. We had cell phone issues. We had no phones, no power. We were fortunate to be able to get generators. But having been through Wilma, it really changes the way you think, and you got to be very proactive. And even to the point of the thoughts on removing airplanes, that if you have pilots that want to protect the family, that you have alternate plans where you have pilots from outside your area that could help you ferry airplanes. I mean, you go into a ferry mode more than an operations mode, and it's a continually coordinated plan that has to be structured, but with a lot of flexibility in it, because none of these storms are ever the same, and we've done a lot. We call them bug outs. We've done a lot of bug outs, and some of them we come back laughing because nothing ever happened. And Wilma really set us on our ear, and now we take it very seriously. We protect the owner's assets. Leaving airplanes behind is not the thing to do because of the risk of the damage. And the big concern is, what if it's not a total loss and you have an airplane that's been rebuilt and you run into diminution of value and so many other things that, you know, the old story about, don't worry, we're insured. The insurance company can only do so much, and you got to be proactive. Right, Tom?
Absolutely, Dave. And you know, you're making some really good points, because I've seen so many operators that they put the airplane in the hangar, they close the door, and they have this sense of false security. And it's truly false, because what we found from 1992 on with Hurricane Andrew and just about every one of these major storms is that these metal-clad, non-combustible sorts of hangars, which the majority of them are built that way, they all become kites at about 110 miles an hour. And if your airplane's in there, it's going to get damaged or destroyed. So this idea of just parking it in the hangar and that you're good, it doesn't work, because it will get damaged or destroyed. In the recovery, in all the expense and the time and interruption that can go on for literally months, and in some cases even beyond a year for very large airplanes, and, you know, you think about it, you've got a very expensive jet in there that's maybe insured for, you know, $20 or $30 million. And if the building falls on it, if it's not a total loss, which you would probably hope for, but suppose it's not, and you've got a $10 million repair that has to be done to it, what's happened to your resale value on that airplane? It's probably lost at least 10 or 15% of its resale value just by having the damage history, even if it's repaired beautifully. So there's a lot of those considerations that have to go into it. And at the end of the day, there's really no valid excuse for leaving an airworthy airplane behind in harm's way. You need to get it out of there and make whatever arrangement you have to fly it out. And I hear people grumbling about the cost of the $10,000 or $15,000 to maybe move the jet, but it's pennies on the dollar compared to what would happen if it's left behind and it's damaged. Some other things that I just kind of want to share with the group, because these are tips that we've picked up from our operators over the years, is with hangar doors, you know, for as long as I can remember, people were always concerned about securing the tops of these doors on the tracks, and they would tie, rope them off, or they would chain them off so that the rollers wouldn't come off the top. And then what we found out with Charlie and Francis and Jean, and even Wilma for that matter, is the doors were actually blowing out from the bottom. And we had one very clever operator that said, you know what, we need to put hurricane pins on the bottom of our hangar doors, and they're spaced, you know, maybe 10, 12 feet apart, and what they are is essentially very strong down bolts that are drilled into the concrete, so that when they secure the hangar, they put these down bolts in, and those have been proven now that it keeps these doors from blowing in from the bottom, and it's been a really great fix, relatively inexpensive fix, and something that works. Another comment I want to make, and it touches on what Dave mentioned, and that, you know, a lot of the buildings are built to these wonderful wind codes, and you think that, well, it's my building is engineered or constructed above the current wind code, but it's not those straight line winds that really cause you the damage. It's the tornadoes that Dave mentioned. And that's where 90% of the damage that we've experienced with four or five storms has always come from the tornadoes that surround or are part of the hurricane itself. And you can't engineer for that. And we found that no matter how that building is designed or built, you're still going to lose a roof. You're still going to have doors blown off and windows blown out. So don't be lulled into that because they're built to the new code that they're going to remain intact if a storm comes through. The other thing that was kind of a myth that we've dispelled is that when people were doing valuations, they would say, well, geez, I don't need to insure the entire structure because, you know, I'll still have the foundation. I'll still have all of this infrastructure to the building that won't get damaged even if the building were to get blown down. Well, what we found is it twists those attachment bolts that go into the concrete, that you actually have to remove all the slabs. We found out that the airport authorities wouldn't even let you rebuild in the same location, that it wouldn't fit their master plan. And in certain cases, it could take them up to 2 years to even get it permitted to let you rebuild. So when you're doing your valuations of buildings, you have to take into consideration a ground-up total cost to replace that at current building codes. And when you're doing your valuations, too, you have to pay attention to the older buildings because a lot of them, you're not going to be permitted to build them with a like kind and quality. You're going to have to upgrade them to the new wind codes, and it's something called a law and ordinance coverage that you've got to make sure you've got some law and ordinance coverage in your placement to take that into consideration. And I guess the other thing that we did learn that I want to just comment on was the communications. We experienced exactly what Dave did. We were all relying on cell phones, and guess what? We found out that they weren't working, and we couldn't communicate for literally a couple, 3 days at a time, or they were unreliable. So what we've done and what we've done had some other operators do is they've actually maintain some satellite phones at their place of business so that they could still communicate even if the cell towers go down. That's another good tip that we found has been useful with our customers.
I've got a comment, Tom. It goes back to flying the airplane out. Don't fly in the airplane out. It's insured. Don't worry. The other thing that operators need to understand is, I think Washington with the hangar that collapsed, what the impact is on when you have a bunch of especially unnecessary losses, but losses that can be controlled, and what it does to the insurance rates. We ultimately all pay a higher premium if we aren't prudent in keeping our losses in check.
Yeah.
Absolutely, Dave. Absolutely. Well, you know, Stuart had asked earlier about deductibles. You know, there was one one carrier and that was pretty proactive after that series of storms of Francis and Jean, where they had initiated a hurricane deductible that applied to fleets. Now, the majority of their insureds maintained, piston-type aircraft for training and training organizations, but they did something that was, I thought was pretty neat too, in that they paid their operators the expenses of repositioning those airplanes, and then they built in a deductible for the ones that didn't relocate them and they got damaged or destroyed. So, there is a little bit of that, and I noticed that some of the larger carriers did want to try and implement something like that, but ultimately weren't able to do that. But you're right, Dave. I mean, if everybody just was lax about protecting their equipment, ultimately the whole industry is going to pay for that with higher rates.
Dave, let me ask you how you choose where to take the airplanes. I mean, obviously out of harm's way, but do you have arrangements with do you have go-to places, or are you just making the decision at the time of the time of the bug out?
Well, what we do is we try to keep the flight operations running normal. For example, one of our bug outs, one of our clients had a business trip to New York, which was well out of harm's way. So what we do is we see if the aircraft are traveling anyhow, if they're going to safe places, then we continue the normal operations. We may alter the crews because if there's concerns about the pilot's family or something else, so, you know, where we may bring in some alternative crews. But then the planning comes in that if you get some airplanes and they're being held there to potentially take business people, family people to evacuate them, we track which way potentially the storms are going. So, you know, the last thing you want to do is crank up and fly to Savannah, Georgia, and while the storms are tracking up the East Coast, and you wake up and you're in the middle of a hurricane. So it's a continual process, it's a lot of communication. We've got two girls that do a great job, and the maintenance people, and we have literally have meetings. It's how imminent the threat is. You could maybe have a meeting every morning, and when things start getting more defined, you may have one every 3 or 4 hours going, now, if we leave now, where are we going to go? What are we going to do? Do we have people that need to go? And then you set times, Stuart, that you say, you know, by 10 o'clock. So you got to deal with your airport also, because they'll start talking about when are we going to shut down the tower? When do the winds get to X? And, you know, you want to be able to get out while the flight operations are still operating under safe conditions and with the control towers active and all that stuff, because if you mess around too long, they'll shut down, and then you are on your own. You file flight plans, you take off, you try to pick up, and it's not the way to do it. So it's a combination of which way the hurricanes are going. I mean, 1 year we're in New Orleans, 1 year we're in Savannah, 1 year we're in Tennessee. Sometimes we even look at going down to the Keys, but that normally is a choice for the rotary wing aircraft, because they have different logistics and different things, and we have potentials of keeping them closer and getting them housed where the jets need to be further away.
Let me, Oliver, you still with us?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm fascinated by this. Of course, we don't get many hurricanes in downtown London.
Well, that's
and,
what I was,
I'm glad
I was,
to say.
I was going to ask you, in terms of your in terms of what goes on over in the UK and in Europe, are there similar areas where there are these natural events that are frequent?
Well, yes, but they don't happen. One thing that leaves us absolutely breathless when we see reports of hurricanes
is quite how quickly they come in. And therefore, your process that you've been describing with great detail is a process that has to be you have to cover the ground pretty quickly, because when those hurricanes come, I guess they come very quickly. We have had that the most recent sort of natural disaster of this kind was
volcanic ash,
the volcano,
yeah.
The volcano with an entirely unpronounceable name. In Iceland, which exploded and covered much of Western Europe with ash, of course the instant reaction was to just ground all the planes. I think that that decision is now being called into question because it is considered now to have been an overreaction. But that was the reaction, such as it was, and it was a natural disaster of some magnitude. There weren't any losses in terms of crashed aircraft, injured people, and so forth, but there was a huge loss in terms of business losses, and the airlines who were involved and who had to cancel flights had to pay huge compensation to their passengers, and of course not all of that was recoverable from insurers. So I think that the European aviation community has learned a lesson from that, and I suspect that the next time round they will be better prepared, which I think comes back to what you were saying, Tom, namely, you've got to prepare yourself, because whatever happens, it is not going to be expected, and you really have to do your homework beforehand. But apart from that, there was just one a small point of irony that that struck me, and that is that in the UK, Typhoon, Hurricane, Tornado, and Tempest are all names of fighter aircraft. Over the years, so it shows how much the British disassociate these things from their aircraft.
Yeah, that's funny.
Yeah, but I think, Stuart, one thing is back to emergency plans. I mean, as it pertains to hurricanes or tornadoes. I mean, in the Midwest, you have tornadoes. You don't really have a lot of time to react, but. Aircraft accidents and everything else tie into your same emergency plan, and it's a different kind of planning, but you have to, I think the key here, Tom, is you got to have an emergency response plan for every kind of a disaster, whether it's a fire, whether it's this, that, or whatever, you know, earthquakes. I mean, you know, nobody's immune in this world.
You're absolutely right, Dave. You know, we haven't had a nuclear problem in this country, you know, for many years, and yet Japan just had their event with the tsunami situation, and you know, that same kind of thing could happen over here. And I don't know how many of those nuclear power plants we even have in our own home state, but that's very real, that you have to think the unthinkable to a large extent. Stuart, if I could just for a second, I just wanted to quiz Dave a little bit on what you had touched on about when you're picking your temporary alternate location to evacuate to, because, you know, we're here in the Daytona Beach area, which is, you know, the home of Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University, and they have a large fleet of airplanes, and they spend a great deal of time on disaster planning and response, and I know they had they moved their whole fleet, Dave, to a location. I want to say it was in the Alabama area, and then they had it was either the same storm that was chasing them that then they had to reposition to a second location, or it was a follow-on storm that was so close to the first one that they had to remain there even longer. And I want to say that it went on for several days, but how do you select your location?
Well, the thing about it is their problems are a lot different than our problems, in the effect that their aircraft are, you know, 100-mile-an-hour, 200-mile-an-hour airplanes, not a lot of range. So there's a big group. In our case, you know, as we all know with hurricanes, the shorter distance they're predicting out, the more accurate they are. So we typically don't react until it's timely to pick a destination. And again, then it ties into aircraft schedules and as to if they're already scheduled to go somewhere. We have a crew that's we have a lot of bachelors in our flight department, so not as different dynamics. But anyhow, but then you backfill with the pilots, and so when we take off, we go a good distance. We'll go 500 miles, you know, and it's an hour and a half, and we have not very often, but in the last minute, said, you know, no, we're not going to go to New Orleans because it looks like the high percentage of the models are showing it more heading more west. We'll head up the East Coast, or maybe we're just going to go ahead and go to Tennessee because we're taking the family out. So it's always it's not an exact science, but I can proudly say we've never been caught with a double move on a hurricane. But you got to, you know, having done it for 20 years, you develop a sense about them. But I can tell you that I was flat foot with Wilma that we were all told, and I think you remember, Stuart, that it's coming back across the state, it's going to lose its punch, and what we didn't, nobody factored in there that I don't think the storm was all that vicious, but it spawned a tremendous amount of tornadoes and did a tremendous amount of damage. And we ultimately, was the first time that we didn't get all of our aircraft out. We had some rotary wing aircraft sitting in the middle of the hangar, and fortunately have sustained no damage. But we have had a lot of conversations, and it's really redirected us in our approach to hurricane and evasion, as you would call it. And it's, you got to be flexible. That's the key.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank everyone for being on the call, being on the show. It was very informative. Oliver, I'm going to see you in Geneva at eBase.
Absolutely.
Okay, we'll see you next week. And thank you for tuning into this broadcast of Plain Talk Radio. I hope you found it enjoyable. Remember, the show can be accessed at a later date or shared from the webpage. I want to thank my guests, Tom Coughlin, David Linnemeyer, of course, my co-host today, Oliver Ross, for appearing on the show. Tom, you have a website you want to let people know about, or other way to contact you?
They could use my email address directly. It's T Coughlin, Coughlin, at air-sur.com.
And Dave, I guess we can, if anyone needs to reach you, they can certainly send emails to airplaneguy at plaintalkradio.com.
That'd be great.
And anyway, check out the 2011 Business Aircraft Transactions Conference at the Hilton, New York, June 9th and 10th. Plain Talk Radio will be on the air live from London the last week of June. Oliver, are you ready for us?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Can you behave at eBase?
And I'll behave. Be sure to tune in. The show will obviously have an international spin to it, and we'll have some experts on European-related business aviation on the show. I've got a few people lined up. Oliver, we'll talk about that later. If you have a new product or service that serves the business aviation community, drop us a note at airplaneguy@plaintalkradio.com. This is Stuart Lapioca, the host of Plain Talk Radio, May 13, 2011, signing off for now. Just a reminder to give generously to Corporate Angel Network, the NBAA, and your local Business Aviation Association. Don't take advice on the golf course about business aviation. And always close with a fizzle. Good afternoon, everyone, and thanks for listening.
Good night, gentlemen.